This is New Classical Tracks from listener-supported American Public Media. If you love this podcast, the best thing that you can do for this show is to tell somebody else about it. Help spread the word and take a moment to rate and review us on your podcasting app. I talked with James Newton Howard recently about his latest recording, Night After Night, where he reimagines music from the movies of M. Night Shyamalan. They've had an incredible collaboration, and James talks a little bit about that and how Shyamalan helped him to see the light in some ways, which actually allowed him to create the suites you're about to hear on this new recording, which features guest appearances from violinist Hilary Hahn, cellist Maya Beiser, and pianist Jean-Yves Thiboudet is featured throughout this beautiful recording. This is New Classical Tracks. It comes to you from American Public Media, and I'm Julie Amacher. Thanks for joining me. First of all, before we get started, how are you?
I'm doing really well, thanks, considering that the world is a little bit difficult at the moment. But here in Santa Monica, I'm doing really well. We're continuing to be productive in my Santa Monica studio. And that's always the thing for me, is to always be trying to do something worthwhile musically and personally. And, you know, I talked to my shrink about this lately. I said, how do you get your head around all this insanity? And he said, try being the best human being you can be. So that left a mark on me. And that's sort of how I deal with, you know, some of the chaos that's in the world. And that does impact all of us, I think.
That's very good advice, to really focus in on what we can do to make a difference, to make the world a better place. Today, when we think of the name James Newton Howard, we think of film scores and all the film scores that you've written. But I know a lot happened in your life before you ever wrote your first film score. And one thing I discovered in researching about you is originally you were on track to become a classical pianist.
I was indeed.
Can you tell me a little bit about that and what your life was like that led you to even consider being a classical pianist?
Well, I started piano lessons when I was four. And I think in the early years, I was quite prodigious, I think is the word. Kind of exceptional for like a four-year-old. And as soon as I got closer to 10, I started to become less prodigious and slightly more mediocre. But I kept going, and I eventually got a piano performance scholarship at USC. And that was very exciting, except for the fact that I knew by then I wasn't good enough to be a classical pianist. In fact, I knew it earlier than that, so I'm kind of surprised that I got the scholarship to begin with. But I was a decent pianist, but I kept hearing young people in the practice room next to me practicing the same thing I was practicing and just tearing it up. So I was simultaneously very attracted to popular music. I felt that this was just too difficult to succeed in. I didn't want to become a piano teacher. And so I dropped out after about 10 weeks, gave up the scholarship, moved on to greener pastures.
Well, and those greener pastures involved Elton John and touring with Elton John. When you had that opportunity for several years, actually, what was most memorable about that time in your life, which was what, like 1975 to 1982?
That's a good question. I think for me, well, first of all, Elton was like a god to me. When that first album came out with those wonderful songs with intense and very present orchestral arrangements accompanying them, that was just a remarkable moment in pop music, as far as I'm concerned. Maybe the Beatles did, of course, that, but it was a different, there was an austere approach to Elton's records, which were piano-based, but then you had a string orchestra for the most part, right up loud with the piano. So when I joined Elton's band, which is a whole long story in itself, I really had no clue about much of anything except how to play synthesizers and keyboards. And I'd never done an orchestral score before, but one of the things I wanted to do most when I joined Elton's band was to write his orchestrations. And we were recording in Toronto, I think, at that time in 1976. And I asked Elton if I could write the orchestral arrangements on his album that we were working on. And he said, well, have you ever done it before? And I said, no, not really. He said, let me think about it. So he thought about it. And the next day he said, yeah, you can do it. Do whatever you want. Which is, you know, I'll never forget those words. So about 6 weeks later, I was in front of the LSO conducting. I guess you could call it conducting. Not really. Just waving a stick around with my head buried in the score and at Abbey Road. And it actually worked out all right. So
what did
it was
you,
just something I... Sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, what were you conducting? What's the first thing you conducted?
There was a piece on the Blue Moves album, which came out in 1976. Called Tonight, T-O, just Tonight, which is a beautiful kind of long piano intro, and then this big, long beautiful song. And so I had this opportunity to write kind of a lovely orchestral part to this prelude, really, before the song happened. And after that, I did several more on that album. So I guess it was successful.
How many times in your career have you heard that phrase, do whatever you want?
Very few. In fact, that may have been the only time I've ever heard it. No, a couple of enlightened directors have said that to me. And of course, when you're working as a film composer, you're in collaboration with a director. So you can't, I don't really want to do whatever I want because I want to make sure I'm telling the same story that the director's telling. And sometimes that feedback, oftentimes from a director, the feedback coming back from a collaborator is extremely important. And other times I try not to hear it. So,
from Elton John, you also went to spend some time with the pop band Toto. And that's also when you got your first film credit. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. I mean, when I came back to Los Angeles after my stint with Elton in the 70s, I had a certain amount of cachet because I was the guy in Elton's band that was doing orchestra. So I started doing a lot of orchestral, like string arrangements for pop records, like for Barbra Streisand, Earth, Wind, and Fire, and a session musician. So I got quite busy as a session musician. And a lot of the Toto guys were also session musicians. We became very good friends. And so I ended up doing string arrangements for Toto as well. And during one session, one of the players, I think maybe principal violin back in a long time ago, 84, I guess, 83, said, James, why aren't you writing television or film scores? And I said, because I have no clue about how to write a television or a film score. So I was offered a movie, which is really unusual, but you know, it was a lot easier to get into the film business, I think, back then, because there weren't 100 people lining up for every job. They offered me a movie and I turned it down. Then I got offered, they kept pestering me, so I said I'd do it. So the first day, I remember this very well, I put up the film and somehow I kind of knew how to do it. Not how to do it all the way, but I was good at it. I mean, it may have been very primitive, but I always had an idea to write something to a scene. In other words, I never got to a scene in that first movie where I just had no clue of what to do. It may have been the wrong thing, but I had an impulse and an idea of what I would try, and it was very successful. So I kept getting other offers, and I knew at that moment that I had found my life's work. Yeah.
Do you think you have a signature style? And if so, how would you describe that?
Well, I do think I have a signature, a style, harmonically speaking. I tend to be very tuneful. I'm kind of a melodist, really, and I kind of can't help but be a melodist. I remember I was working with the wonderful arranger Marty Paich and showing him some of my scores, and he said, James, why does everything you write sound like a melody? Can't you just write some gestural things or connective, recitative kind of things? And he had a point. So I think strong melody is part of my signature. But I think also, and I say this with tremendous humility, it may not sound like humility, but I really mean it that way, that I'm very versatile. So I think I've done a lot of successful romantic comedies from Pretty Woman to My Best Friend's Wedding to Dave and all that. And then, so when you do that, you become the rom-com guy. And then I did The Fugitive and I became the action guy. And then I did something else, you know, minimalistic things with electronics. So I think all of those things are part of what identifies me. I suppose the clearest thing that I get back from people is my more emotional kind of interior music, is what I would call it. I love writing about love. I think to some extent, one has to try and identify with every character in a film to really get in there. But yeah, I hope that was helpful.
Very helpful. I was reading an interview that you did a few years ago, and these are your words. You admitted to being a little arrogant on occasion early in your career. And then you said you became a good listener. What happened that allowed you to become a good listener?
I was arrogant because I'd been with Elton John and I was a decent keyboardist. I could play pretty well and I was always coming up with ideas. And then I was just running into situations where I was getting a lot of rewriting request from the director, which of course is every film composer's lot, is rewriting, and it's burdensome. And some of the rewrites they were giving me were really good ideas. And I thought, I didn't think about that. And then it just occurred to me that the director might actually have important things to say to me. And so I softened up quite a bit. And decided that, I want to make sure that my storytelling is accurate in parallel with what the director is trying to say. Doesn't mean I can't offer insightful alternatives and reveal things that the director maybe didn't imagine were in the movie. I'm much more collaborative, and that's really the nature of the game. You know, it's all down to being part of a team.
You have collaborated with a number of directors, and there's one in particular, M. Night Shyamalan, with whom you have collaborated on at least 8 films, and you've now taken music from those films and turned them into suites. Why did you want to create these suites?
That's a very good question. You know, somehow the music I did for Night, starting off with Sixth Sense, Signs, and Unbreakable in The Village, which some people may be aware of, some not, but I think most of those are pretty successful movies. But they all seem to be of there was some kind of connective tissue with all of them, because perhaps the writing was more minimalistic, not so much ornamentation from the orchestrations. After the first movie we did together, Sixth Sense, was nominated for a number of Academy Awards, I was not nominated, but Knight got on the phone with me and said, well, James, the reason you weren't nominated, and I was sort of going, okay, do I have to hear this? I've already been nominated 6 times. But actually, he said something very interesting. He said there was no singularity to any part of the score in The Sixth Sense. In other words, you couldn't hear a few notes say, that's The Sixth Sense. I think the perfect example of that is Jaws. When you hear dun, 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 you know that's Jaws. And so he asked that the next film we do, which was Unbreakable, that I start writing before he starts shooting. And he brought me out to Philadelphia. He storyboarded the movies for me. And so when I left, I really felt like I had an idea of what the movie was going to be like. And so I think out of that idea of creating a more singular, simple idea and trying to score, keep that alive through the entire score, was a structure I had never done before. And that was pretty consistent through all the 8 movies I did with him, a couple less so. And so when I was sitting around during the pandemic and my kids were all in college and somebody was doing this, and I was the only person in my house that wasn't doing anything, because I just finished a movie and I couldn't quite finish it because nobody was going into the cutting room or the recording studios. It occurred to me that, these scores have always kind of caught my attention to some extent. They felt like they could be an interesting work in and of themselves. So what I did is I took the scores, I created 8-minute suites of them, but I wrote a considerable amount of original material to help flesh out ideas that I couldn't flesh out in a movie, because you could be writing an idea down and all of a sudden a car blasts through the wall and you have to stop that idea and deal with the car. I took out all the scary bits and made it quite meditative, really. I got Jean-Yves Thibaudet's piano-centric, played the piano through most, in fact, on every track. Hilary Hahn came and revisited my score for The Village and played the beautiful violin solos throughout that piece. And lo and behold, they did feel like they were similar DNA, if you'll excuse the hackneyed or too often used expression. But yeah, they felt of a piece to me. And I started working on it, and it just really worked, I think. Came out really beautifully.
As I was listening to these pieces one after another, I literally thought to myself, well, this could be its own film score. Did you get that sense as well?
Well, you know, I was thinking of it, I guess, the story to some extent, but of what the storytelling was like in the scores. But yeah, they were based on film scores. So I guess, you know, they still sound to some extent. And what I mean by film scores, what do we mean by film scores? Well, very melodic. I'm not quite sure what is a film score without the film, but I think I try and write substantive music, even if it's simple. I try and keep it interesting enough that it can be played or heard without a film. And that's what I wanted to do. I didn't do a mashup. This cue, mash it up to this cue, and it wasn't like that at all.
That's so interesting, because we often say the film wouldn't be the film without the music. You know, the music really enhances the film. So it's interesting that you're posing that the other way around. What is film music without the film?
That's a good point. I never thought about that, but I couldn't agree with you more that, you know, not in every film, certainly, but in many movies, people don't really understand what the music's doing to keep their interest, to point them in the right direction. Whose emotional point of view are we in from one moment to the next? The moving aspects of a great score connecting to characters. So yeah, it was just wonderful to revisit all those in that sense.
So did Hilary Hahn and Maya Beiser come back in to re-record these pieces then?
They did. I was incredibly fortunate to get them available, have them come and be willing and be available, because, you know, concert artists, as you well know, are booked a year or 2 years in advance. So I did get Hilary on the record. Unfortunately, there is stuff coming up next year, performances that she isn't available for. That's okay. But I think Jean-Yves is going to be available, because we've worked that out. And he's just so wonderful. And I love him so much. And he played this work so magnificently and gently and with force and passion. So he's everything that I could have hoped for in a pianist.
And the thing that you and Jean-Yves Thibaudet have in common is that word versatility. He has done so many different things, not just classical music. I mean, he's a concert soloist. He is a collaborator with singers. He's done film scores. So he really is a good fit for this.
He really was. And I knew that he had worked with other composers on their film music and to very successful outcomes. So I couldn't believe that he said yes, actually, that he would do this album. But he was aware of my work. And when I sent him the demos, because I make very elaborate demos with synthesizers to indicate what I've composed, I sent him the demos and he was up for it. And fortunately, I got him for a whole week and we spent 5 days together recording the album. Hillary was able to come for a day. My advisor was able to come. And so it was just kind of a dream.
What an interesting trio. But they weren't all there at one time, right? They all had to come in on their own schedule.
Well, Maya and Johnny was there with everybody because he was there for the week. And the album is all piano centric. Hillary would come in for a day, and having Hillary and Jean-Yves play together was, you know, I'm standing there going, wow, is this really happening? And then Maya came in and played with Jean-Yves. Just delivered a spectacular performance. So, yeah, I mean, there was quite a bit of co-mingling, if you will, of the three artists, but Jean-Yves really being the centerpiece of the whole thing.
I want to talk a little bit more about the work that you do with Shyamalan. What do you most appreciate about collaborating with him?
That's a good question. Knight makes films that are about things that really interest me. Revelation, catharsis, love, courage, triumph. There's always an element of these very strong emotions. And that's what really appealed to me. But surprisingly, all these ideas took place and these feelings took place in movies that were somewhat creepy. So I thought that was unique. You have a kind of a creepy movie, a lot of things happening, never a horror movie, ever. But you have some, you know, kind of spooky stuff going along, but then there's a very emotional core to it. And I found that was just, I had never encountered that before. And I couldn't really think of other movies that had that same, well, maybe Poltergeist a little bit. But what I loved about Knight was the closeness of our collaboration and his appreciation for what I was doing, because he gave me a movie that, say, the second one on Unbreakable, which at first glance, you wouldn't think that it's a big orchestral piece. And so I sent him a couple of ideas, which were not big. They were sort of piano-based. And he picked one. And then, lo and behold, as we got into the movie, I went really big with orchestra, like full orchestra in a couple moments in the film. And he just was so excited by that. And we just ended up having this connection from the very beginning, where I felt challenged and I felt inspired and he felt inspired, and we worked so closely together that it just was kind of a dream relationship.
I did read one story, and now I can't remember the film, where he had you write the music, and when the two of you got together to preview it, you both kind of looked at each other and went, this doesn't work. Can you tell us that story?
Yes. This was on a film called The Village. And The Village is this wonderful movie about a group of people that are almost kind of, I don't know how you would, almost a religious group, but not really. They're a community that's based on ceremony and tradition, and they're very closed. And there's a scary part to it, which they say never go into the forest because there are monsters out there. And it turns out to be quite beautiful in the end. But so I had written an action score because I think the studio wanted to promote it as an action movie. And so when Knight and I watched it together with my demos here in my studio, there was a pregnant pause. And we looked at each other and said, I think this is a love story. I don't think it's an action movie or a thriller. And so I said, I agree. What about if we make the protagonist is a woman. What if we get or ask a woman to play a violin part through the whole thing? Mm-hmm. keep some of the scary bits. So I rewrote the score. I called Hilary Hahn. Never really, somehow, I have so much regard for these superstar classical people. I'm always kind of astounded that they want to collaborate with me, but they do. And Hilary said, sure, I'd like to do it. And so I sent her the music, and she started calling me from the road every 2 or 3 weeks saying, James, this doesn't really work. You know, the fingering in the section is kind of a problem for me. I said, oh, okay. I'd go back. And then she'd call a couple days later and said, oh, never mind. I worked it out. And that happened a couple times. And when she showed up to do the recording, she was just spectacular. I mean, she was so serious-minded and formidable and such a fierce and amazing musician. Everybody was just kind of astounded. You know, I full orchestra, myself, Knight, everybody. And yeah, it was just a glorious experience.
I have talked with all three of these classical artists who are featured on this recording. And now I'm thinking, wait a minute, these are all perfect fits for you because Hilary has done so many different kinds of projects as well, just as Jean-Yves has. And Maya Beiser just did her first, what you might call, classical album.
Yeah, she's amazing.
You know, recording the Bach suites. And so really interesting. And one of the things that I think is so important is what's happening is when people hear these artists in the movies, you know, what they don't even realize is they're actually hearing classical music. A lot of times people think that, oh, that door to classical music isn't open for me. I don't really understand it. And yet there's lots of ways to be introduced to it. And you're helping make that happen.
Well, I guess to some extent, you know, certainly it is orchestral music that's probably, without question, based on 19th century romanticism and, you know, obviously beyond that, Stravinsky and Ravel and Debussy. But the classical music idea, comparing film scores to classical music, I think is a fine idea, although I'm reluctant to call film music the new classical music, because when I'm in a concert hall listening to Thomas Otis or Esa-Pekka Salonen, which I heard recently, and watching Dudamel and just hearing all the remarkable artists up there and the compositions, I'm reluctant to say that most scores are classical music, because they're not. They are related to it, and they will often bring audiences into the concert hall, and that's really helpful. But I have too much a regard for that the higher level of classical music, concert music, if you will, to think that generally speaking, film scores are classical music. I use that word very carefully. Occasionally, I think it's true. But does that make sense?
It does. But what I'm saying is you're opening the door for people to consider other things like Thomas Addis and Beethoven, who, if I'm not mistaken, is one of your favorite composers. Is that right?
He is. He is indeed.
And what is it you love about Beethoven? What makes him one of your favorite composers?
His combined muscularity, his force of, you know, he's a force of nature in terms of the intensity of the music, his lyrical ability, the tenderness of his writing, the triumphant feeling of a lot of it. So all those combined, along with the ferocious piano work, and people don't really, maybe most people don't understand, Beethoven is underestimated by a lot of people as being difficult, because this, somebody once said, you need more technique to play Beethoven than you need to play Beethoven. And I understood what that meant, that, you know, there's some extent you can play Beethoven to a certain point, but then when you get into something like the Last Sonata or the Hammerklavier or some of these pieces for piano, legendarily difficult, as far as I'm concerned. So I guess those are the emotional quality to it, the triumphant quality, and the real tenderness and the yearning.
Which composers have you maybe channeled when you've written some of your own pieces, and why?
you know, I really believe we're an amalgam. We're kind of a, you know, a stew of everything we've heard before. And I somehow believe that in part of our brains, we remember some part stashed away in our brains that remembers everything we've ever heard. And I kind of feel that way. I can identify things in my work that I'll say, oh, those three notes, that reminds me of a Coppertone suntan lotion commercial in 1962 when I was growing up. And so I can identify elements of what came before me a lot. But I would say Brahms, Beethoven, love Tchaikovsky, and then love Stravinsky. I mean, I love them all. Ravel, Debussy, of course. Rachmaninoff, I'm a total fan of. I think harmonically, he was just, what he wrote was just so gorgeous. And in a funny way, I kind of relate Rachmaninoff to Chopin in terms of the things that Chopin was doing harmonically and pianistically were really revelatory, I think, for the time. And then I think Rachmaninoff too often has been sort of not appreciated enough because of the harmonies that he created, and obviously the piano writing is extraordinary. But yeah, there's a whole 25 composers that have influenced me. But I think the most probably Beethoven, Ravel, Brahms.
If I was going to share an example of one of your film scores as you're talking about this, which one would you point me to that it's like when you say Rachmaninoff or, you know, whichever composer, you might hear elements of that in this score?
Well, I did a movie a few years ago called Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them, which was the prequel to Harry Potter movies. And, you know, I did three of them, and each one of those movies had 2 hours plus of score. So I think it would probably be the second one, Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them, the second movie, which is called, I think, The Crimes of Grindelwald. So these are bringing, yes, I think that's a good one. I think Maleficent. I did a movie with Angelina Jolie, which is about a character named called Maleficent, which is a wonderful kind of Disney fantasy movie. Any of my big scores, those two, you know, I can just hear it in so many scores. But I think if you listen to those couple, I think that would be somewhat revealing.
I want to go back to Fantastic Beasts because you said something about that in an interview, how like the first 45 seconds of that was the most challenging because you were sort of following up on what John Williams had done in all the Harry Potter films. Can you share that story, please?
Yeah, I mean, the first Fantastic Beasts I had written, I'd been working on it for five months, and we were getting ready to record it. Now, that's a long time for a film composer to have to write a score. But it was a complicated movie, a complicated score, and I started working on it and sending David Yates, the director, these demos that I was making. And a lot of them he loved, a lot of them he didn't love. But eventually, after about 5 months, I had written and had approved and recorded, not recorded yet, most of the score, all of the score, except for the main title, which comes at the very front of the movie. And it starts with Hedwig's theme. And then it goes into what was going to be my piece of music that's going to be the standard bearer of this brand new franchise, Fantastic Beasts, 45 seconds long. And after the very opening over the Warner Brothers credit. So I had 45 seconds to conceive of and make an imprint that was going to last forever, at least for these movies. And I hadn't succeeded. And it was 6 weeks away from recording. And I was really getting kind of panicky. And so I tried every one of the main themes, which is what you would sort of try at the beginning. It's logical to try a main theme from the movie. And none of them worked. One of them was just way too romantic. One of them was terribly wrong, sounded like a funeral dirge. Another one just sounded like a circus. It was just silly, silly stuff. And I was trying really hard, but still was turning out quite wrong. And eventually I wrote something that was kind of triumphant for a character in the movie called the Thunderbird, which is this wonderful, magical bird. It was an excerpt. It was a fanfare from the middle of that piece of music. And I took that and tried that, and everybody loved it. And I kind of loved it. And David Yates, everybody, we were cheering. And he's finally done it after all these months. And the next day, I was trying to remember how it went. Let's see. It goes, no, that's not it. And I knew right then that I didn't have it. I didn't tell anybody, but I went back several days later and was noodling around at the piano, and I came up with this. I would play it for you on the piano. You can't hear that, right?
Yeah.
You can? Do you want me to show you what happened?
Yeah.
I'll do it really quick. So I was messing around with, for some reason, this. These kind of like sharp five ideas. So then I eventually added some harmony to it. And it was like, I liked that. That kind of thing. And what I liked about it was it had an exotic quality to it. It was really raising the curtain on another world that you haven't been to before. And even though it wasn't traditionally melodic, It just brought something to the movie that really worked, and everybody heard it. So I demoed it up. Everybody heard it, and we all went crazy with happiness and joy because I've finally written something that I thought would work. And yeah, that has been. Otherwise, if I hadn't succeeded, it would have been Hedwig's theme through the whole deal. And I wanted very badly to get John Williams out of this movie. As much as I adore John Williams, and he's remarkable, nobody like him. But I wanted it to be my own. And so I got there eventually.
I do have one other question about this new recording, and that is the work that British conductor-composer Gavin Greenaway does. He's conducting the orchestra and the chorus. Where are we hearing the chorus? I thought I only heard them maybe on one track. Are they somewhere else?
Well, they're very subtle. There's no big... You probably heard that... Well, there's one track, I think, from... After Earth is probably the one you heard it primarily. Also, it's in Lady in the Water. A little bit in The Last Airbender. Which is just more pads in the background. I think in the Sixth Sense, I think it's just sort of sprinkled in a number of the pieces, but most of them are quite subtle, and they're just kind of way in the background just to give a little atmosphere to these things.
Who is in the chorus? I mean, was this like a chorus that you just pulled together for this recording?
Yeah, this is the London Voices, they're called. I've worked with London Voices on 15 scores at least. They're wonderful. They're enthusiastic. They're extraordinary singers. And yeah, it was London Voices.
Have you ever had aspirations to compose what you would call a classical piece of music outside of a film score?
Well, I have had those aspirations and I fulfilled them a couple of times. I wrote a violin concerto commissioned by James Ennis, the wonderful violinist, and we recorded that with the Detroit Symphony several years back. I'm in the middle of writing my second violin concerto. I've written the first two movements. That will be premiered, I believe, the week of January 3rd in Dallas with the Dallas Symphony. I've written a few things that I'm quite surprised that they work. But, you know, because it's a daunting thing for a composer to go into the concert hall. There's no dialogue. There's no cars. It's all you. Period. And nothing to hide behind. And so I take it incredibly seriously. And I'm absolutely terrified whenever I start to do one that I said yes. Why did I say yes to that? I don't know how to do that, but I ended up giving it my best, the old college try, and it worked out all right.
And then, I'm guessing maybe this isn't an issue for you, but I'll ask it. When I talked with Danny Elfman after he wrote his violin concerto, he said that he got a lot of pushback, you know, because he's tried to be in so many different worlds, you know, like, you can't be a film composer, you're a rock artist. You can't be a classical composer, you're a film composer. Have you experienced anything like that?
I haven't, because I think, you know, to a large extent, most of my scores have been orchestral. And sort of, I would say, classically based, no question about it. So I think it felt like a natural transition to a lot of people. And I was asked to do it by a lot of people. So I didn't get that kind of pushback. But I can totally understand how that could have happened with Danny, because he started off in such a different way. By the way, that violin concerto, I think, that he wrote is really, really special and very good. But yeah, I didn't get that kind of pushback. In fact, what I loved about writing for a concert hall, I got no notes from the director, no notes from the producer. We don't really like that theme. Oh, that's too busy. Or, you know, can you thin that out? And that kind of stuff happens all the time. And so I got no notes.
What's interesting about that is they were probably waiting for notes from you.
Yes, that's a very good point. You know, my feeling is that, you know, and I'm sure you've heard this before, that the performance is really the final rewrite. And the performers really should get the credit for that. You know, you don't have a lot of time to rehearse in classical world. You get like two rehearsals, a dress, and that's it. You know, in my world, I could take one big piece of music that's maybe 3 minutes long and spend 3 hours recording it. So I had to get used to this whole, the way things work in the concert hall.
Yeah, it's a real honor, I think, for classical artists to get to work with a living composer, because they spend so much of their time having to kind of guess, right? Like, based on what was on the score and what other people have done. And so that's a real thrill for them, I'm sure. James, what's on your bucket list yet in terms of perhaps collaborations or things you'd like to compose that you'd be willing to share?
Wow. You know, I've been so lucky. I mean, I've done over 140 movies, I think, at this point. Endless things for television, record producing. I've been so lucky to get all these ideas, writing concert music. I may have ticked off all the things, may have ticked all the boxes that go in a bucket list with music, and I just want to keep going. I mean, I can't imagine. I'm always excited about a new collaboration, of course. That would be a bucket list, I guess. But I'm just open. I just have an open mind, and I'm still very enthusiastic. And I still have an incredible passion to do it. And I guess that's my bucket list, is to have remaining and continuing passion for what I do.
Are there any films that you're working on or that you can share? Anything we can look forward to in the future from you?
Yeah. There was a book, All the Light We Cannot See, that was, I think, won the Pulitzer Prize in 2015, which I loved, by Anthony Doerr. That's coming out on Netflix. There's a four episodes on that. That comes out, I think, November 2nd. And it's a great book, great story, but World War II story about a blind girl and a German boy who in the beginning are at opposing ends, but they end up, he rescues her. It's a whole love rescue kind of story, but beautiful. And then I think November 27th, if I'm right, or somewhere around there, is the prequel to The Hunger Games, which is really good. It's really substantial. It's intense, but it's really good. Of course, it's a prequel, so Jennifer Lawrence isn't in it, which is fine. But it's cast in a way that you don't have to, the whole story is in a way you don't have to have seen the other Hunger Games to enjoy it, which I think was really smart. And I'm proud of that score. I think it was different for me. A lot of woodwind writing, a lot of stuff that I don't really get the opportunity to do that much in film scores. Some directors just don't like woodwinds. In fact, I'm not going to name the director on a huge movie that I did. For some reason, the bassoons came up, and he said, "I want no bassoons on this score," which I thought was hysterical. So there weren't any bassoons on that score, but there was a sequel, and I made a point of putting a lot of bassoons.
Any final thoughts from you that you want us to know about you or this new recording?
Well, let's see. The new recording, I think you have to listen to it to really understand what it is, but I think it's got a kind of a calming quality to it, which is something I wanted to maintain or create at this point, because I really was feeling, you know, such a chaotic world we're in, and the pandemic and da-da-da. It's really what I was hoping to realize. And I spent a lot of money doing it. So, because I really wanted to have the full orchestra. And Sony, of course, Sony Classical was very helpful. They threw in a lot of money as well. And they've been so supportive. And yeah, it's everything I dreamt of doing with this work.
Awesome. So no AI for you. You want the real thing.
Well, certainly. I don't know. My wife used ChatGPT or whatever it is the other day. Because she was writing some summation of a board experience she was on. She was having trouble with it. She put it in there and she was just thunderstruck, jaw dropping. Couldn't believe what it came back with, and nuanced. But everybody knows this already. Put in a couple of nuanced requests and came back again, just perfection. So I don't think she's going to use all of it, but it certainly is a helpful tool, I think, when you're writing. I hope it's not a helpful tool when you're composing, but it probably will be. I think AI has probably got, it scares me to death. And I think ultimately we don't really know what we're doing with AI. In fact, I heard a guy on 60 Minutes, British fellow, saying, who's kind of considered for some reason to be the godfather of AI. And the interviewer asked him, do human beings know what they're doing? And he said, no. And that he felt that ultimately AI would become smarter than us and could be dominant over human beings at some point in the future. So that part I don't like, but I don't think AI will be able to score a movie with the nuance. And I think they can write music that sounds like me. That's probably not too far in the future. But I can't actually score emotional point of view from one scene to the next, at least in my lifetime. And if they do, then I'll be out of work. But that's okay. I've had plenty of opportunities to work, and I'll be grateful for that forever.
It's a new recording that reimagines music from the movies of M. Night Shyamalan, the music composed by James Newton Howard. Thanks to Valerie Kaler. She's our producer for New Classical Tracks from listener-supported American Public Media. I'm Julie Almacher.